Hey, busybodies, Frank and Paul here. Before we get into this episode, we just want to quickly address what we've done in this particular episode. Paul?
We decided that this particular show worked a little better as two shows, part one and a part two, partly because by the time we were done yakking, it was a little on the long side. And second, because while the topic stays the same, email overload, it takes a bit of a turn right around the halfway point, where we shift from the day-to-day trials of communication overload into the longer-term, more serious mental health implications. And we decided that's a pretty important topic that deserved its own show. So today we present you part one of a two-part email episode.
So enjoy the show, folks. It's business. Hello, busybodies. Welcome to another episode of The Busyness Paradox. I'm Frank Butler, here with my co-host, Paul Harvey.
Good day, Frank.
So, Paul, tell me, what's on today's episode?
I'd like to talk about one of my favorite, least favorite topics, which is email. Email overload and the paradox of email and efficiency. So, if we kind of step back a little bit and think about efficiency in the context of communication, efficient communication has as little friction as possible, lowest amount of cost and effort involved. There's really nothing more efficient for communication than email. And yet, I think a lot of people would argue, I am certainly one of them, that at some point, email hit a tipping point for a lot of us where it's not a gain for efficiency anymore. I would argue, at least, that for many of us, it's now a cause of inefficiency. Possibly because it's so damn efficient. Because anyone can just fire off an email, drop of a dime, it's quick, it's easy, it's efficient. Now, responding to that email, things start to get a little bit more interesting. And you notice there's this whole kind of cottage industry that's popped up of ways to make your email more efficient, ironically, than it should in theory already be. Different apps, different web services that automatically will filter emails, automations that will help you kind of speed up the response process of emails. And my argument is that these things do make us more efficient at communication, particularly through email, but in a way that just compounds the larger problem. So we get more and more efficient at something that was already pretty efficient. And what I particularly notice is that the more you become known as a fast and efficient email responder, the more emails you get. If you become the fastest way to get information, people will go to you for that information instead of trying to look something up for themselves or figuring something out for themselves. Let's shoot an email off to Frank and he'll know what to do. And so you become ever more involved with emails. There was once a point in time where I told my dean, I said, if somebody came to monitor me at work for a week, say, just sat in the background, took notes, but say this person had no idea what my job actually was and was trying to guess, they would say this guy is a professional email responder who a few hours a week goes and stands in front of some students in the classroom for some reason and says some stuff, but then he gets back to his main job of responding to emails. The burnout from this is affecting more and more people. I myself, as you know, didn't respond to email for almost a year at one point. It became such a psychological, I don't even know what you'd call it, a psychological barrier formed in my mind that I just couldn't deal with. And really, I'm only now kind of getting past that. So on a really kind of deep psychological level even, a case can be made that email has become a destructive force for a lot of us.
You know, I would say it's probably been compounded by the fact that we have so many different ways of quick communication, right? I mean, if you think about it, I'll fire off an email to you, but then I'll also send you a text mm-hmm. about something else, right? And it's like, holy crap. And so we're having to juggle these different mediums. You know, I've got WhatsApp installed and I connect with my veterans in the Veteran Entrepreneurship Program that way, or they'll message me through there, or they'll message each other, you know, and I try to keep up with that. But then we also have the email chains going on, or, you know, and now there's different places for all of it. Typically, we don't just have one email account, right? You know, you've got your work email, you've got your private email, you've got your iMessage or SMS messaging, you know, all this stuff. I think it's just, it's all compounded, right? I mean, I remember when we first had email, you know, and that was back AOL days, and it wasn't so bad because you were using email and instant messenger, but there wasn't this like critical mass of people using it yet. You know, we're still talking the infancy.
Right. It was a niche communication medium back
right.
then.
Right. You know, my friends and I would be on instant messenger, you know, back in high school, like early high school when we couldn't drive and stuff like that, yep. you know, and you'd still talk on the phone more, right? I remember when my plan on my cell phone back then changed from you got 30 minutes a month to free nights and weekends.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a big deal, right? You know, we weren't messaging that way either. There was a lot less communication going on, or not less communication, but less ways of communicating.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it.
And I think that's maybe compounding the issue that we're seeing here. And to your point, one of the situations I've been dealing with is I get really frustrated when my students don't respond back to an email that I've taken time to craft and send to them. They're asking me for assistance, right? It's like they don't send back a simple thank you just to acknowledge they've received it. You know, I don't care if they action on it or not. I mean, I think they should action on what I send to them, but I think you and I both know that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. It's just, you ask my advice, here's my advice. Whether you follow it or not, that's up to you, but at least it's there. I've given it, but you should at least acknowledge that you've received it.
See, now, I actually reached a point where I preferred people did not do that.
Interesting.
Because that meant one more email in the damn inbox. And, you know, you click on it and, okay, it's just a quick thank you. Then you move on to the next one, but still seeing that number in the little red circle get bigger and bigger and bigger. Feel your phone buzz, bzz, bzz, bzz. Oh no, not more emails.
Yeah, you know, for me, I think it was a closure kind of thing. It's like, okay, that's done. It's off my plate, right? So I felt like that was checking a box and saying, hey, I've done that. I've answered that person's issues. They've acknowledged it. So it doesn't feel like it's outstanding for me. But I can certainly see if you're backing up in your inbox, you're going, this is too much at this point, right?
Yeah.
I could see there's a relationship where eventually that you hit that tipping point where all of a sudden you're like, this is too much. I can't deal with it.
And that's a good example of where efficiency becomes inefficient. The way you're talking about it, that's the way it should be done. You send somebody something, they acknowledge receiving it, close the loop, all good. But if there's so much efficiency that there, it's just so easy to send stuff back and forth that you reach the point where you just can't handle another damn email, efficiency has kind of come full circle and bitten you in the ass.
Right. Right. Well, I know in your case too, you were in a very unfortunate or unique situation, both unfortunate and unique.
Yeah.
But,
and that's, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do think that's a relevant confounding factor in my case.
Right.
And maybe we'll get into it in some episode or something, but I was unbeknownst to myself at the time going down a spiral of dual tick infections and really losing my ability to communicate, especially through written formats. So yeah, that definitely aided and abetted my personal email decline, right. But that almost brought clarity to it. When I got to the point where I just couldn't communicate through written words anymore, I looked back at how much time I was spending
on email.
On emails. And you know, I say I can't respond to emails anymore. They say doctors and such would ask, like, well, how many are we talking here? And I'd say, you know, 300 to 500 a day. And like 300 to 500 responses, like actual actionable response things. They'd say, how did you ever do that? I said, well, I don't know, but the thing is I used to be able to and now I can't. But I was able to because of all these efficiency assistants that are out there and this getting things done philosophy of productivity, which there's an interesting tie-in between my gripes about email and this getting things done philosophy. I don't know if you're familiar with this guy, Merlin Mann. He was a software guy, an avowed Macintosh enthusiast.
He's already a good guy right there.
So we know he's solid.
Yeah.
And so he read this famous book, Getting Things Done by Dave Allen, and really became a champion of it, including this idea of inbox zero. He was, my understanding is, he was the one who kind of coined that. Hmm. And he would do seminars and he had this blog and this whole kind of thing about how to attain inbox zero, like basically turning your emails into a production line operation where you're just banging out responses and getting things done. He himself got so burned out on doing that, that he's now kind of change sides in this thing to say this endless pursuit of efficiency is killing us because where we're gaining these efficiencies are in the administrative aspects of our job, not the real value-added stuff, the innovation and the creative work. It's making the administrative stuff ever faster and more efficient. And in the end, we're just becoming robots. So now he's completely on the other side of it, saying, forget your email. Don't even pay attention to your inbox. I kind of followed his path, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I certainly have not been up to the level of 300 to 500 emails in a day.
Well, remember, I had like 1,200 students at that time.
Yeah, that's you
that
had
a unique
lot of,
situation. Yeah.
Yeah. But I get certainly the notion when you start having too many, that's almost when you need somebody who's just responsible for handling that aspect of it, right? That seems like, you know, what a CEO would deal with, and that's why they have an executive assistant whose job is to really manage those, right? You know, to answer the ones that they deem as being not as important for the CEO to answer, and then making sure that the ones that the CEO does need to answer get through to the CEO, right? So one of the things that I've done is I've started to use smart mailboxes in my Apple Mail, for example, and that helps tremendously because that means that I know which buckets are important. And I don't mean that like anything's less important per se, but I certainly do have that triaging going on where it's like, okay, if it's going to one of my research group folders, that's something that's related to a project that's open or under review and resubmit or something along those lines. I have all my, like, not spam per se, but those groups you sign up for, those newsletters, all those things, I have those going into a different folder.
I have a quasi-spam folder for that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not exactly spam, but yeah.
Right. And the rules I have set for that is basically they're marked as red, right?
Yep.
So they don't even come in. I don't see a bubble for that, but I do have a folder that I can go to. So I, you know, I've tried to be better about that because I found that I would get at least irritated by the amount of, you know, email that I'd have to review that's not that important. And then at the end of the day, I don't know about you, but like, I know for us, our school spams us to death with emails, you know, and I have a folder I actually named All the Junk and I have certain, just because it to me, a lot of it is like, I mean, to be quite honest, we got a lot of emails about, you know, math colloquium this week. And I'm like,
oh, yeah,
cool. That does not pertain to me. I'm not that keen on it. So I deal with enough math as it is. You know. So I have that stuff like that go to all the junk and I'll go back and review it on occasion, you know, just to make sure I'm not missing anything. I do not have those marked as unread. But because they're in a different folder, they don't show up in my inbox red numbering, right? So I think that helps tremendously.
It does. And we have actually talked about this before. I think this is a topic worth pursuing in an episode.
The organization kind of...
The things that everyday people like us can do in terms of automating the routine aspects of our work. With the caveat that, again, that involves making you perhaps too efficient. So if you've just got your email routine locked down, you become that super reliable, super fast source of information. Eventually, your lockdown email routine gets overwhelmed from more and more people sending you stuff. So how do we know where to stop? When does the pursuit of efficiency bring us to that tipping point where we're just not able to do our jobs anymore because we've become professional email responders?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think it means that there does need to be some sort of triaging, right? I think you have to be able to say, okay, emails from this individual or associated with these projects are important. So I'll have those obviously be the things that come up first or what have you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But even if you get more efficient with email, I think what's good about that means that you're able to spend more time in that personal development end, maybe, or working on other things that can benefit you or the organization. And I think, you know, if it's benefiting you, it probably benefits the organization because you're developing skills. And I think that goes back to something we've talked about too, is just the company should be more than happy for you to be developing your skill sets and then figuring out ways of how they can apply that in-house. I know one of the things we've talked about is sort of this internal Uber for doing things, right? Where I'm really good at something, but it's not really a core part of my job. But I'm also really good at my job and I get things done. And instead of me just twiddling my thumbs and acting like I'm busy, you know, I use that time effectively and I get, you know, rewards for that, right? Whatever the company deems is a way of maybe incentivizing people to contribute in other ways, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. I was just thinking some people are good at this automation stuff with emails and with other stuff too. You know, back when I had my 1,200 students, collating all these different spreadsheets with all these different bits of information for each student was this monstrous task. And you know, one of my friends said, "Yeah, give me a night with it. I'll code up some macros for you." And the next day, click a button, done. Like, wow, that was 9 hours of work
Wow.
in one click of a button. for him to put that together was, you know, it probably took him an hour.
Yep.
For me, that would have taken a week or two of figuring out
right.
the ins and outs of virtual basic and blah, blah, blah. So I think this is a good potential application for the Uberization of the workplace that we've been talking about. But, you know, it kind of brings to mind another paradoxical phenomenon. Think about what we're talking about here. Structuring ways to become more efficient in our emails or other aspects of work and seeking out help from other people to do that. And even sending lots of emails in the first place. A lot of this kind of looks a lot like people creating structure for themselves in a job where maybe there's just not enough structure. If you go back to the, you know, early 1900s, where nearly all work was done in a highly structured, be it assembly line or, you know, scientific management days when efficiency meant watching people do their jobs and look for the smallest little things you could do, like, ooh, put that pile of parts over there so they don't have to turn around. And then we had this huge shift, Peter Drucker's stuff in the mid-1900s, going along with the increase in what we now call knowledge workers sometimes, folks who are doing jobs that aren't just assembling things, aren't just straight production.
Yeah, coding, right? These kind of coding jobs or R&D type jobs, yep. There's not a lot of structure, right? It's sort of, you got to do what the outcome of the project is, right? So you've got this kind of, yeah.
And you trust the knowledge worker to know more or less how to, you know, within reason, how to arrive at that. So there's this big shift away from having supervisors really micromanaging their employees, saying that, okay, you're the expert in this area. We'll assume that you're able to figure out the best way to do your job. And to varying degrees, I'll let you do it. Think about how drastic that was a change in a really short amount of time. From early 1900s, mm-hmm. what it meant to be a manager was one thing. And then by late 50s, 60s, 70s, it was something completely different. Now a manager is someone who monitors employees from afar and kind of gives them...
I was going to say, manages, you know, email. Manages email.
Manages email, yes. They used to manage people, now they manage emails. And I like autonomy as much as the next guy. I think it's a good development. But I wonder how much of what we're seeing here is a result of certain jobs having too much autonomy, not enough mm-hmm. structure, to the point where people have to create their own structure. And one way of doing that is by shooting emails all over the place. How should I do this? What should I do next? You know, in the old days, you would have a boss who you just asked that boss. Now it's like, who out there do I know who could answer this question? Shoot off an email.
That's actually interesting because I know, like, we can talk about networking and stuff like mm-hmm. that too, like how you develop networks and how you have these central nodes and networks and, you know, each person brings something to the table. So if you're like an information getter, right, you could be a central point where people reach out to you frequently because you know who to go to get help in that. And I'm wondering if that doesn't apply more in this context now with email and the ease of communication.
That's a good point.
And so certain people are probably getting more emails than others even, right? Yeah. If you're one of those people who just knows where everything is, you know, I think about kind of when I was working in Germany, a lot of our subsidiaries, they would reach out to me first because I would be able to connect them to the right person in Germany, for example. And so I would get a lot of communication that way. But then I started thinking about my job too. And I did a lot of just managing projects, right? So I would be emailing a bunch of different people about things and just tracking it versus, you know, necessarily doing a lot of hands-on stuff anymore, right? I mean, I would be doing some hands-on stuff, but certainly a lot less than when I was just working quality control and trying to figure out how to go through a testing program and those kinds of things. And it's very different, right? Just very different mm-hmm. being the central contact point for a lot of people. That's where they came to, but it was facilitated by the notion that we had email because especially when you're dealing with 12 different languages, it just made it easy for them to write English, right? Because they, you know, either they could translate or whatever. So it was a form of communication that was probably a little easier for them to be clearer with.
Yep.
Or at least, if anything, give me the opportunity to be able to decipher their English if it was less clear. And, you know, we would get to a point of understanding quicker yep. in some cases. But, you know, to your point, there was a lot more information exchange, a lot more emails. But I'm wondering if there's like not sort of components that apply to that. Obviously, in your case, you had a bunch of students being sort of a central communication point for a lot of your, like a lot of contacts. You know, those people probably deal with a lot more inflows and outflows of communication. Management, obviously, I think probably a lot more so too, because they're trying to just manage. And I'm wondering if you're not correct in saying we probably need to think about the structure of management jobs And that actually makes me think about that Harvard Business Review that just came out by, I think it's Podolny is his name. He's the dean of Apple University. It was on the way that Apple actually does things, right? It was on that sort of how the management managed in essence. And, you know, their leadership and how they use their time was very interesting because they were saying that, you know, you got to be an expert in something. And so their management were all kind of developing this expertise and they are experts in their areas. But at the same time, because they are taking on more areas of responsibility, they have to learn to delegate more too, right? They have to learn about stuff and they still have a lot of learning they do, which I think is important, right? Because as you become a manager, you become a generalist, right? You go from developing expertise, and it's not that you want to lose that expertise, but much more so that you have to learn more about different things, which actually enhances, I think, in a lot of ways, your expertise compared to lower level, right? Because if you're coming in, and I'll just use this as a quick kind of example. If you're a Java programmer and you come in and you're programming Java, and people who are in the IT industry, don't blast me on this. I'm just throwing it out there as an example. If you start with Java and you came in and you're really just become super proficient with Java, you start moving up and you become part of this program team. And not only are you having to lead over Java, but now you also have to include other programming languages underneath like Python. Okay. So now you have to learn how Python works. And I think, you know, because you have a foundational base of Java and a great understanding of how that works, you have that foundational knowledge of how computers think in a sense, right? How they process information. Maybe you're becoming less of an expert in Java, but now you're creating a broad set of expertise so you can work with a lot of people because now you understand probably a different level of how the computer works. You know, there's different expertise that goes through each of those steps.
Yeah.
You're an expert in Bluetooth. You're an expert in Bluetooth technology, but you're not necessarily an expert in the software side. You might be on the hardware side and vice versa, you know, so.
I think that's an important distinction there that I hadn't thought of. So kind of specialist versus generalist. You become more of a generalist as a manager. And I think that's part of what is happening. People who are not managers are kind of being, I don't want to say forced into, but informally required to be generalists themselves because you're taking in information from unpredictable places. And simply by virtue of trying to respond to those people, you learn more stuff. And that can be a good thing. But the distinction is, you know, is it actually helping you to learn all those things at that point in your career? Or is it taking your focus away from what you're actually supposed to be doing? Like your example of working in Germany, being that central communication point, a hub in the spoke of people, makes sense. If correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that was actually part of your job. That was just something that organically occurred.
It probably was because I was over international sales and partnerships. Yeah. And so technically it did apply, but people would reach out to me beyond just simply sales type things. You know, like they would want to know other information or, you know, what have you. So there was some overlap, but because my expertise was technically in managing our relationships with those outside of our company, but also working within our company to help expand our sales to our customers and so on, you know, especially as we acquired new subsidiaries and such, you know, I think that just sort of naturally then became part of my job too, is anything else is like, okay, he's going to at least know because he's in headquarters, you know, and connected to everybody. And
I think the point still holds then. So you were in something of a kind of managerial function there. And so you were doing a managerial sort of thing when you are connecting all those people to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is kind of an important distinction that, you know, a manager doing those things is, you know, they're doing their job when they do those things. Someone who's not in a management position, who's doing those things, is being distracted away from their job.
Right. Right.
One of my stories I like to tell, I realized that I was losing the email battle when like 90% of the emails I would write were apologies to people for, you know, falling behind being on late. Their deadlines because I was answering their emails. You know, it's like, it just became this downward spiral like that.
But wasn't that already normal? Weren't we, you and I both kind of always a little bit, not, I don't think procrastination is the right word. I just think kind of pressure cookers. We like to work more under the deadline pressures.
Yes.
And so while we're, I think we're kind of type A-ish in a sense, we're really type B in a lot of other ways, right? Because I think in this profession, you have to be type A.
In some ways.
In terms of you have to be. Yeah. But then I think in other ways, you can really be a lot more laid back. And I know for me, deadlines, man, they're my favorite thing because it's like, that's when I start really getting to focus, right? Because I feel like I got all this time otherwise. And
I wish it wasn't that way. But
yeah, I'm wondering if it compounded that even some extent. Because, you know, it's like there is a point where you start stressing out. And that's sort of what happened to me, too, is that all of a sudden, like, you have all these things going on. And you're like, I no longer have the time. Mm-hmm. And then you just do nothing, right? Like, all of a sudden, you let it all go, in a sense, because you've this is sort of what triggered my anxiety problems was this very, I just kept doing more work. Mm-hmm. I didn't create any balance and I just kept saying yes to everything. Yep. I think is what was problematic. And while it was great because I was getting a lot of rewards for all of that, right? Because I mean, I was publishing a lot at that time, you know, I was teaching a lot of overload because we had this new online program. And so, I mean, it was like making, you know, better money and, you know, it was exciting. And, you know, the people at work were coming to me because they're like, hey, you're doing this stuff and you're killing it. We do this too. And you're like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, and it's like, hey, you know. And then next thing you know, you're like at a full stop, right? Yeah. Nothing gets done. And you just
seize up.
Yep. Yeah. And then that's, I think, the trouble with being that. And so there's probably a lot of different things that have to be done. I mean, even if you were to get better organized with how you handle things and become more efficient, let's say in emails and what have you, I don't think that solves the larger issue that you're dealing with in that context too, right? I think just the email happens to be, or messages in general tend to be the sort of catalyst or another variable in the breakdown, I guess.
It's,
you know,
true.
So there's other, you know, I think that you had also taken account personal life aspects too, right? So, you know, you're dealing with that stuff. You throw in the, you know, somebody has a family then too, and they've got kids to worry about. You know, I think these just all, and you've got your work pressures. And so
you've only got so much energy.
Right. Your identities overlap too much then. You can't separate them as well anymore. And just it all collapsed. Now, of course, I think that's on the extreme end. Yeah. You know, and I think it could even be said if you don't have kids that it can happen too, or a significant other. I mean, that's what happened in my context. I didn't have a significant other or anything. I just kept doing more and more and more and was just chasing the reward.
And that might be part of the problem. There's no external support.
There is no balance, right? There was no balance. No balance. And, you know, just chasing those rewards. And that's damaging, right? In its own sense.
It is. And, you know, you mentioned something a minute ago about, you know, you could spend more time being more organized and do all this stuff. But, you know, think about what we are. You and I are college professors. Like, we're not paid to be organized, you know. We're paid to be the opposite of organized.
Creative. We're in a creative function at the end of the day.
Yeah. You want to think of things that haven't been thought of before and test them and teach about them. And none of those things are compatible with developing a foolproof email response machine. It's unfortunate that we even have to have this conversation. And I don't think we would have been having this conversation 20 years ago, 25 years ago, before everyone had email.
No, I think there's other things that we would be dealing with 25 years ago in this case, right? I mean, think about just how much technology has changed how we do things. You know, we write a paper now, we send it back and forth to our co-authors. Once we get to a point, we submit it online. You know, we're not having to go and print out three versions of it and then package it up and mail it and have to deal with all these other things. You know, I think there's different layers of challenges.
But look what's happened there. Now we're all expected to publish three times as much because it doesn't take weeks to send stuff back and forth.
It's like not only are we expected to publish more, but because there's so much more volume going on.
Because it's more efficient.
Yeah, more efficient. The tools have gotten better.
There's more volume.
You know, that's unique to, obviously, academia. But I think that's not necessarily, there's not necessarily aspects of that that's not happening in corporate either.
Or
nonprofits where, you know, the expectations, because things have changed, that now you're expected to do more. I mean, again, not necessarily bad, but it does change the notion of how do we have to think about the work function too. But then you have to throw on top of that, hey, you know, you got to answer emails that you didn't have to do before. You just answer the phone every once in a while, or, you know, your boss checks in on you face to face. And there's some comfort when your manager comes in face to face.
So I think you've touched on something.
I've touched on a lot of weird
one thing in particular that I was paying attention to, the kind of the paradoxical nature of efficiency. And again, like you said, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think in some ways we're kind of selling ourselves a false bill of goods when it comes to becoming more efficient. Like, oh, look how much faster I can do this. That means more time for me. No, it means more time for you to do more stuff. And not necessarily value-added stuff, but back to our namesake and the whole idea of being busy all the time. When the important part of your job gets faster and faster, sometimes we end up filling in the void, not with relaxation or creative thinking or whatever, exercise or something, but with busy work.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to think about that notion of technology can make us efficient, but then it also means that we're trying to, you know, either by your management's perspective or your own, I need to be doing more, right? That notion of I have to be busier.
Right. Whether it's a impression management thing or if it's actually semi-legitimate, like there is more work that needs to be done. We're understaffed, whatever.
Or just internal, intrinsic, right? Intrinsic. I just have to be doing something. Mm-hmm. You know, some people just have to be doing something, right? Mm-hmm. So there's different levels, right? Impression management's not you feeling like you have to do it, but intrinsically you feel like you have to do it.
Yep. And it's a reasonable thing, especially if you're at your job, you know, you're kind of in that mode. Like, all right, I want to be productive. I already finished my work for the week because everything's so efficient. Now what? Oh, yeah. And like you said, someone asks you, would you mind helping with this? Yes, I'd love to. Next thing you know, you're wildly overextended, sleeping 4 hours a night, developing like alcohol problem or something, which personally, I think that's where a lot of modern alcoholism comes from, is this feeling of like always being stretched and always having something else that needs to be done. As I think it's a way for a lot of people to kind of turn that off for a few hours.
We'll pause this discussion on that uplifting note. Please join us next week for part two of this episode. And thank you, as always, for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Busyness Paradox. Our show is distributed by Paul Harvey and Frank Butler. Our theme music was adapted from It's Business Time by Jermaine Clements and Brent McKenzie. Our production manager is Justin One Take. We all hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send questions, comments, or ideas for future episode topics to input@busynessparadox.com or find us on Twitter. Also, be sure to visit our website, busynessparadox.com, to read our blog posts and for links to the articles and other resources mentioned in today's show. Finally, please take a moment to rate and subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or wherever you found this episode.